Live from Texas, it's John Mayo with the Mayo Report.
Okay, the numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top 300 comics for July 2008. And yes, we just talked about the June 2008 numbers, it seemed like.
Last week.
That's what happens when they release the data right after I've left town for San Diego. Then have to deal with, you know, being out of town for a week and a half, catching up from being out of town for a week and a half, and all that stuff.
Yep, and then we had lots of other things. You know, we had the San Diego wrap-up stuff, we had the previews episode to get out, and all of these things conspired with pushing the June Mayo Report way back in the month, so it came out late. And we're back on track now, so we'll get this one out, and you get Mayo-y goodness 2 weeks in a row this way.
Well, actually, 3 weeks in a row, because next week will be the trade edition with Chris.
Yeah, I'm not involved in that episode, so I don't give a crap.
Well, all right then.
Not really. I listened to it.
Well, July was an interesting month, and a lot of things really popped out on the list, but starting with the breakdown of the top 300 sales. So, as should be no surprise, Marvel had the lion's share of the top 300 comics, both by units and by dollars. And this time they had 48.47% by units and 48.74% by dollars. Coming in the next highest share of the pie for just the top 300 comics was...
Let me guess. It's DC. Right?
Yeah, I know. You're good at this. Jeez, you've been paying attention. They had 34.52% of the total units sold for the top 300 and 33.21% of the dollars. And then coming in below that is Dark Horse in third with 3.89% by units and 3.58% by dollars. Huge difference there between that 33 or so, you know, for DC and that 3 or 4, you know, for Dark Horse. And we talked about this some last time, how there's this big gap between the two big dogs and kind of the, you know, I guess the minor leagues, if you will, not to be confused with the farm teams, which we'll get to before too long, with the sub 1% or whatever. So it's really a tough market out there for anyone who's not Marvel and DC. And frankly, even inside of Marvel and DC for some of their titles. Coming in the fourth largest share of the top 300 was Image, with 3.87% of the units and 3.95% of the dollars. Now that means they were 0.02% behind Dark Horse in terms of units. Very, very narrow gap there. That works out to about 1,300 copies or so, or 1,300 units.
I wonder if you take Kirkman's books out of the mix, where does Image fall? You know, it's like, how much of Image's sales is Kirkman? You know, they made him a partner recently.
They made him a partner.
A lot of people have been talking about, and you know, but you know, hey, someone sells like half the books or something the company's putting out by units, and it's time to make him a partner.
Do you count Brit as one of his titles? I was going to say I would too.
Yeah, because he created it. If there was no Kirkman, there would be no Brit. So I'd say Invincible, Walking Dead,
Astounding
Brit,
Wolfman,
and Astounding Wolfman, and
that comes up to 56,958 units or thereabouts for Walking Dead 50, Invincible 51, Astounding Wolfman 7, and Brit 7.
And how much did Image do in total?
Image did in total 278,314 units.
So 20%, not quite as much, little, you know.
But that total for Kirkman, which again was that 56,958 units, would have put him at, well, it outdid Devil's Due. So it would have put him at rank, I think, 8. So, I mean, Kirkman himself outdid a number of publishers. Matter of fact, he outdid the majority of the publishers. Only Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, the rest of Image, IDW, Dynamite, and Zenoscope outdid him. But again, that gap between Dark Horse and Image, very narrow, and Image beat them out in terms of dollars because their average price worked out to $3.43 versus an average price of $3.03 for Dark Horse.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming in fifth place for the breakdown of the top 300 is IDW. They had 3.46% of the units and 4.25% of the dollars. So IDW had a higher dollar volume than either Dark Horse or Image. And then the only other publisher with more than 8% of the sales of the top 300 by both dollars and units is Dynamite Entertainment with 2.18% of the units and 2.2% of the dollars. But there was one other publisher that had over 8% by either units or dollars, and that was Devil's Due. While it only had 0.71% of the units, it had 1.07% of the dollars. And part of that is the average cover price. When you've only got six items that range from $3.50 to $5.50 cover price, that worked out to an average of $4.83. That's treating each item equally. It's not a weighted average based on how much they sold.
Mm-hmm.
So, pretty interesting. IDW is still doing pretty good, but didn't beat out Image this time like they did last month. But again, it's right up there with Dark Horse and Image. It's really which way the wind shifts as to how that middle rung is gonna work out from month to month. Which, again, I think is great. I think this kind of competition is good for all of the companies. You know, it's a little disturbing when Marvel and DC account for about 83% of the total sales, and then once you add in the other two premier publishers, you've accounted for about 90.75% of the unit sales. So you add in then IDW and Dynamite, and then there's less than 4% of the units for the top 300 for everyone else to fight over.
Yeah.
But this is pretty common. You know, I'd like to see a couple of these in what I'm going to call, for lack of a better term, kind of the farm team publishers of, you know, the Zenoscope, Devil's Due, Boom, Virgin, Radical, Oni. I'd like to see them start getting a little bit, I don't want to say healthier, because none of these guys are in bad shape, but a little bit bigger and account for a little bit more of the share of the market. Maybe one or two of these. I certainly think a few of these have the potential of getting into that middle level, kind of the minor leagues, where Dark Horse, Image, IDW, and Dynamite currently are. And eventually I'd like to see somebody make a run for the major league and give Marvel and DC some serious competition. It would help Marvel and DC, or encourage Marvel and DC, I should say, to produce better material and fight for their sales a bit more than they're having to now.
Yeah.
The other thing that I thought was interesting about this month in comparison to many months is where that bottom listed item sold. Rank 300 this time, which was reorder activity on Incredible Hercules 117, had 4,255 units approximately sold. Now that means the list is bottoming out well over 4,200 units. And typically we've seen stuff well below this in the 3,000, 2,000 range, you know, showing up on the list. In the past, it's gotten as low as 600 or 700 units for rank 300. So the fact that it's this high, I see, is a really, really good sign. And the median sales for the list for the top 300 worked out to 13,832 units, with the average being 23,991 units. Quick refresher course, average, take all the items, divide by 300. The median, however, half the items did better than this, half the items did less than this. And essentially what you're doing is taking ranks 150 and 151 and averaging them. I see the median as a little bit more meaningful figure because it's not skewed by the top-selling item or items, which sometimes do, you know, much, much better than the rest of the list. And this time around, we had five items that did over 100,000. And, of course, the top one of those is the number one rank item of Secret Invasion number 4 with 175,410 units. That's only off by about 239 units from issue 3. Now, that's a 0.14% drop from the total known sales of number 3. That's negligible. I mean, that's in the noise. Now, I don't think that's like a rounding error between, you know, the estimation from last month to this month, but it's insignificant. So I think that implies Secret Invasion is doing a very good job retaining readers, which, you know, good for Marvel. Number two item on the list is not Final Crisis, and the reason it's not Final Crisis is it did not ship in July. Issue number two shipped at the end of June on June 25th and was in the numbers we discussed last week.
Number one, you mean?
No, that was number two.
Okay, right. So number three then shipped first week of August.
Yep, on August 6th. And that was the same week that the director's cut of the first issue came out, too. So they had no Final Crisis issue itself this month. If they had, I still don't think it would have taken the second slot. Because rank number two was Uncanny X-Men 500, which did 151,912 units, which is up about 70,852 units, which works out to about 87.41% of an increase.
What did Final Crisis number two sell?
Final Crisis number two, let me pull up the spreadsheet from last month, and it sold 126,020 units.
So that validates, I mean, chances of it selling three selling more than two are relatively slim based on how the sale trends go. So it would have been number three, right?
Probably.
Probably.
It certainly would not have been number two, depending how much it dropped off. If it goes by the average, which again, mathematically speaking, nothing will. You know what I mean? It would have dropped about another 10 or 11%. And that would have put it at, let's see, we'll say say it lost 11%, which is about average. That'd put it at about 112,000.
Which would have squeaked in at the number three slot.
Yeah, yeah. If it lost, you know, that. And again, it's hard to tell how well that one's going to do.
I mean, it's the main DC event.
It certainly, I think, would have come in the top five. I think it certainly... It's just a question of would Astonishing X-Men number 25 in rank 3 with its 110,693, would that have beat it out or not? And it's a coin flip, you know.
Well, we'll see when we get the next numbers how many it actually sold.
True, but that's not to say how much it would have sold had it come out even a week earlier.
Yeah.
Because had it come out that week earlier, it only would have had the first week sales to count, whereas coming out the first week of August, it's got same month reorder activity for the other weeks of August that'll get included in.
That's true.
And it would have been up against a different set of comics that week. Now, based on the feedback we've been getting on our forum from our listeners for the budgeting questions we talked about in the last episode for this, most people seem to be budgeting on a monthly basis based on what's in the order form. But I think a lot of that is also skewed by a lot of our listeners shopping through DCBS like we do, where you're ordering it on that basis. I'm curious how many people who go to the shops every week are budgeting on a monthly basis versus a weekly basis, and how that influences their buying decisions. But either way, Final Crisis probably would have been, you know, ranked third or fourth thereabouts. But didn't ship, so didn't rank. The top-selling DC book for July was in rank 5, and that was Batman 678 with 103,184 units, which is down about a little over 7% from the previous issue, which isn't too bad. And that includes both the base cover and the variant cover of it. And I don't know off the top of my head what the ratio was for the variant cover. Probably I would guess maybe a 1 in 25, but I'd have to go look that up. The other item we talked about last month in terms of Event Comics was Ultimate Origins number 1. And you were saying how you didn't feel it was really an event comic. It would seem like a lot of people agreed with that because it dropped a little over 41%. To fall out of the top 10 at rank 11 with 80,366 units, which is a drop of nearly 56,000 units. And that seems really harsh. Now, I think part of this is it seems to be kind of standalone, you know, single-issue stories grouped together.
Well, when I read it, I mean, I liked it just fine. I mean, I liked it as a cool story in the Ultimate Universe. Now, when you have an event title, I think a lot of people who don't normally, you know, who reads anything in the universe is going to buy that event title because they think that it's such a key thing tied up with the whole universe, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And on that one, since it just seemed like, you know, a story, some people might have tried it out. But then, you know, the other thing is I think a lot of people, and you do the trade stuff too, I think Ultimate sells really well in trade in general, Ultimate stuff, since it is sort of that separate kind of pocket universe. And maybe, you know, like a lot of things, I think people try out a first issue, and if they like it, maybe they don't buy the rest of the series, and they say, oh, you know what, I'll pick up the trade when it comes out. I've heard that, which ultimately I think is almost a counterintuitive thing because, you know, it's something – well, it's not like Marvel's not going to put out a trade of Ultimate Origins.
Right. It's a given.
There's virtually nothing that could happen that would prevent Marvel putting out – a trade of Ultimate Origins, you know, so people dropping off, it's not going to affect it. Now, with an indie publisher, you know, a huge drop from issue one to issue two could cause the title to get outright canceled and the series never to be completed, you know.
Yeah, we've seen that a few too many times for my tastes.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is with something like Secret Invasion or Final Crisis is, like you were saying, everyone who's getting stuff in that universe is likely to pick it up or at least consider picking it up. While that's true for Ultimate Origins, the Ultimate Universe isn't that big. You've got Ultimate X-Men, Ultimate Spider-Man, Ultimate Fantastic Four, and what's the other one I'm forgetting about?
Spider-Man, X-Men, FF.
That's it, yeah.
And then whatever special book they might have coming out at any given point. I'm almost thinking that FF and X-Men might be on their way out, you know, just from trends and looking at solicits and things like that.
Yeah, I think they're trying to shake up the Ultimate line, and I think that's a good move. But there's just not enough to really boost an event unless it's a really, you know, a solid event that hooks on the first issue. You know, we'll see how, you know, the Ultimate line does going forward. It's not doing poorly, but, you know, it's not doing gangbusters either. It's not the top-selling stuff for Marvel these days. At one point, it was with Ultimate Spider-Man. But
yep.
What is interesting is Buffy the Vampire Slayer did make it back into the top 10 with issue 16 at 82,008 units, which is an increase of almost 2% over the previous issue. That title continues to do well and, you know, is going to, I think, hover right around that bottom of the top 10.
The power of Whedon.
Oh, yeah.
You know what's interesting to me is I don't believe Buffy the Vampire Slayer is selling 82,000 copies on just comic book fans who are in the comic shop anyway. I mean, certainly it is a Dark Horse book. And if you look at the fact that Dark Horse sells, you know, 3-4% of the market, you know, most comic book fans don't even give Dark Horse a second look as they're stampeding to the Marvel and DC books in the comic shop.
Yeah.
So the fact that Buffy, and this is just through Diamond, right? So this isn't even counting what Buffy's selling in Borders and other places that it's getting exposure to.
And I would think it does fairly well in there because of the brand awareness.
Right. I mean, it could very well be in total sales, you know, up there, you know, toying with these top sellers, you know, X-Men and Avengers and such.
I would think less so on the monthly side, definitely so on the trade side.
Yeah. But my point is that I would be really curious, these fans who are being drawn into the comic shop to buy Buffy the Vampire Slayer, what else are they buying while they're in that shop?
I would think they'd be likely to consider checking out the Angel and Spike stuff over at IDW, but I'd be hard-pressed to name anything else I would suggest to somebody who came in specifically for Buffy.
And I'm not talking about suggesting. I'm just saying, what are they really doing? You know, when somebody comes in to buy Buffy the Vampire Slayer,
yeah,
what do they carry up to the register with them? I'd like to hear from, like, you know, if we've got any retailers listening, you know, what do you see? You know, your non-hardcore comics fan, if you've got someone coming up to your register with Buffy, are they buying Buffy and then some trades? Are they buying some manga with it? Are they trying something like a Batman or a Secret Invasion or something? Or do they maybe buy Dark Tower? You know, and even Dark Tower the same way. I mean, Dark Tower, you look at that, it's at slot 15. You know, that's another one that I think, you know, Stephen King fans and such are coming in to buy it. I really don't think that's where it is because the people buying X-Men are suddenly buying Dark Tower.
Yeah.
Or something. You know, I think that it's bringing an infusion of new people into the comic shop, which is a really great thing. I'm just curious as to what's the buying pattern? What are these people picking up in that shop? That'd be a good question to ask any retailers we talk to.
Well, and a similar question along those lines is not only what are they buying, you know, in addition to Buffy, but what sort of things are they looking for and not finding that they would like to buy? In other words, we've got potentially a different customer base here looking for that stuff. If there was something else on the rack, I mean, what sort of things should be added to the diversity of comics that may be missing that these people would be picking up if it were there? Because I certainly question with these people who, like you said, coming in for Buffy or Dark Tower, are they coming in for that and that's it? Are they getting other stuff? And is there other stuff they would get if it was there? I mean,
well, you know, it's interesting, or do they just not notice it, you know? Because, like, for instance, you look at something like Supernatural coming out from Wildstorm,
mm-hmm.
and that's got to be somewhere on the line, on the list here, that Rising Sun series.
Did it come out this month? Let me filter the list by DC, and let's see if we can find it. As I recall, it's not doing all that great. It's rank 179... with 10,673 units.
Yeah, well, it just seems to me like, you know, there'd be some crossover between Buffy and Supernatural. I mean, they're similar. Buffy started, it was a WB series. Supernatural's on the WB. Their TV shows hitting a similar demographic, or even that Chuck series, you know, something like that. You know, someone who's coming into a shop to buy Buffy might be inclined to try those out. However, most shops rack their books by publisher and or alphabetically. And if I go to find Buffy, I'm going to find it in the B's. And, you know, I might see Chuck or I might see Supernatural and I might not. You know, it's not like all the TV tie-in books are necessarily in the same place where you might get some crossover audience from someone who just wanders into the shop to buy Buffy.
Well, that's a good point. And the next time I'm at Austin Books, I'll try to remember to look at where they rack Buffy versus Supernatural and Chuck, because Austin Books does genre racking, which whenever I'm going in looking for a specific thing drives me nuts, because, I mean, part of it's they're also been renovating the store over the last year and shifting things around on a regular basis. But even prior to that, I had a hard time finding things because I wasn't sure what genre they'd consider it.
Well, you know, something like the TV books, you know, it's like even someone going into the shop to buy Heroes, the Heroes graphic novel, right?
Right.
You know, hell, if they're in there buying Heroes, maybe they'd buy Buffy. Maybe they'd buy Chuck. Maybe they'd buy Supernatural. Or a lot of these things, you know, they're properties that, you know, whereas someone who is familiar with Buffy or, you know, Heroes would be familiar, they'd at least have heard of Supernatural, you know, even some of these other ones like the Halloween or Friday the 13th books that Wildstorm gave a shot to, or, you know, the Star Trek or Star Wars or any of these other media titles.
Yeah.
You know, people will have heard of that. But, you know, and even though it's like a good book, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, I don't know what the hell that is. It's got a raccoon with a gun on the cover. I mean, that's cool to me, but, you know, so that might not, you know, appeal to that same audience. You know, they're not going to necessarily be drawn to Nova or Booster Gold or, you know, any of these things that they've never heard of in their life.
Yeah.
But, you know, they see a bunch of other, you know, TV movie properties all kind of in the same place. And, oh, that's cool. I didn't know they made a comic book out of that. You know, so
well, and again,
marketing at the store level.
Yeah. And again, that's why Austin Books does rack the way they do, is they feel that
that's atypical.
Oh, I agree. I agree entirely.
I don't know that I've seen that at any other shop I've been in besides Austin Books.
I am trying to think of if I have seen that at any of the stores.
So rare that it doesn't, you know, it's like maybe one other and it's not coming to mind.
It is uncommon, but that's why I'm curious where these titles are in relationship to each other at that specific store. And because, again, this is the atypical store where you would think, if I went in looking for Buffy, you know, what would I see near it that I might be tempted to get? And if even at this sort of a store, you wouldn't have that kind of, you know, if it's not in physical proximity or not, you know, that's the question. Because I usually spend enough time looking for what I'm looking for that I don't spend too much time looking for what's around it. But I am curious about that and how well it works out for stores that do it. But it's one of those things where that kind of a genre racking system is trying to encourage impulse buys and crossover stuff. And while I am certainly prone to that myself, there's no question about that. Typically when I go into a comic store, it's because I'm looking for a specific item. And I find genre racking, you know, counter to defining what I'm looking for in a timely manner sometimes. But certainly I think that's one where you're right. It's
and, you know, like you point out, they could have all the other books, all the superhero and all the other kind of stuff, you know, the other genres kind of mixed together in alphabetical order or by publisher or whatnot. I mean, I personally think that you shouldn't do it by publisher because it's good to mix, you know, the Dark Horse and Image books in alphabetical order with the Marvel books. But I would make personally an exception to the media tie-in stuff and kind of put that somewhere else. I mean, you're not maybe missing out on getting the crossover from someone coming in to buy Buffy that might buy a superhero book. But you know what? If someone's coming in to buy Buffy and they have any inkling that they might want to buy one of those other books, they can look almost anywhere else in that shop and find it. It's not like it's going to be hard to find a superhero book in a comic shop. You know, whereas if you got all the TV and movie things in one place, I think that's a much more natural you know, way that somebody might choose to look around and say, hey, I'll try that out.
Well, it's interesting you mention that because at Austin Books, they seem to essentially treat the Marvel Universe and the DC Universe as genres and group those titles that way. Whereas I have to wonder if they were to treat that as just an overall superhero genre and at least mix the Marvel and DC titles for the superhero stuff together, if that might lend to a bit more crossover between the two publishers for the readers. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're into Spider-Man, yeah, there's no reason you wouldn't be into Batman, you know? Whereas segregating it the way they do kind of reinforces the either you read Marvel or DC. But, again, that comes down to marketing at the store level and, you know, what is the more effective ways and, you know, again, buying habits for both the readers and at the retailer level and stuff. You know, how do the retailers see the comics? How do they rack the comics? And how does that influence how the customer sees them and how they buy them or don't buy them?
Yeah, absolutely.
We had a couple of titles that saw some interesting bumps this month. Detective Comics 846 in rank 18. It went up by, let's see, 23,501 units to go to 72,397 units. It's about a 48.06% increase. And I believe that was the first part of the Batman RIP storyline for that title. Yeah, it's part one of the five-part storyline, Return of Hush, there. So not a surprise for that bump. Now, the one that it is a little surprising but makes perfect sense once you realize what's going on is down at rank 28, and that's Trinity number 9. Now, down at ranks 36, 39, and 40 are issues 6, 7, and 8, respectively, of Trinity. 6 did 53,284. 7 dropped a little to 53,393 units, which is a drop of 891 units. And issue 8 dropped another a little over 1,000 units down to 51,362 units. But then number 9 appears to have bounced up 10,873 units to 62,235 units, which appears to be a gain of 21.17%.
What's the deal with that?
Well, note that I say appears.
Yeah. Okay.
Only the first 8 issues of this title, I believe, were returnable.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So the other ones, Diamond, like they did on 52 and Countdown, were essentially hedging the numbers by 20%. So we're seeing the same, what appeared to be a spike in sales, you know, that we saw on those other two titles. We're just
seeing.
So
what that actually means is that the other ones were probably physically selling more copies, but since they're returnable, Diamond was not counting them or something?
Diamond was not counting them because they might come back. Now the question is, did they come back or not? And we don't know. We don't have that information available. Now, with Countdown and 52, I believe in some of those cases we actually saw reorder activity, certainly I think on 52, implying that the initial numbers were, you know, at least stable. But potentially these other numbers for 6, 7, and 8, and really for the first couple issues as well, were sort of as low as they could have been returned down to. So this is one that's an anomaly of the way Diamond is reporting the numbers versus how things actually seem to sell. But that's why sometimes you got to dig a little bit deeper and not just go for the surface level, you know, as to what the numbers look like.
Which, again, you know, you're always saying in your caveats, and it's like nothing is perfect. You're never going to have a completely 100% accurate number of everything that's going on because there's just lots of stuff that happens that skews the data. But, you know, from a trending point of view, you got a fairly accurate vision of what's going on.
Well, and by and large, what we're seeing on Trinity, aside from that jump, is it's losing, you know, about, say, 2% in an issue. This is, you know, that standard attrition everyone's talking about. And it's still doing, you know, over 50,000, you know, with issue 8, now over 60 with issue 9. People are wondering, are they going to do another weekly title or not? Based on these numbers, if I were at DC, I certainly would. Even with the expectation that Trinity may trickle down to 45,000, 40,000, even that still puts it in the top 50 potentially. If you've got a weekly title with a good exit strategy, again, we've talked about this sort of a thing before, it makes sense to do. You know, particularly if you've got a creative team that can do it on a weekly basis and keep people interested. So while Trinity is selling under Countdown and 52, I still think it's a good success for DC at this point. Now, not the success the Batman RIP stuff is, because we're seeing bumps on, you know, a couple of other titles as well, like Robin jumped up. It didn't jump up. It doubled in sales with the first part of the Batman RIP stuff for that title. It is only a two-part storyline, but it's down, you know, rank 35. It went from 26,201 units on the previous issue to 53,865 units on issue 175 there. That, huge success. But again, how many times can you do that kind of a big Batman event and get these kinds of bumps? And again, how long are they going to stay? Some of it'll stick for the second part of this, but probably be gone after that, unless they've got some other major shakeup coming. What else do we have that looks interesting? If we jump down to rank 94, we've got a title that's doing pretty well, and is no surprise there. That's Walking Dead 50. It did 27,683 units. It's up almost 20%, part of that being it's a 50th issue, and that tends to get a bump right there. It was 10 weeks late, hopefully with Kirkman focusing on his work there. We'll see this book get a bit more timely. And it's one that, just looking at the entire run of how that title's been doing, has just really been, you know, climbing the charts. You know, it started back with that first issue at 7,266 units, dropped on that second issue to the low point for the title of 6,067 units, and then started climbing its way back up. That third issue, it was at 6,992 units, and then from there, it went above where it started and has pretty much kept climbing ever since. There have been a few months where it lost a little bit of ground, 100 units or whatnot, but the trend line for this has clearly been up really since that second issue to third issue jump. And the fact that it's climbed up to that 22 to 23,000 level stably has been a good sign. I certainly don't think it's going to keep this 27,000. I think it'll A lot of that will go away, and we'll be back at the 23,000-24,000 level with the next issue. But, you know, the trend is still up on this title and very good. It, however, was not the top-selling Image title for the month. Above it was War Heroes in rank 77, and that did 30,637 units, making it the top-selling Image title for the month.
That was a good book. We talked about it on episode 50.
Yeah, it was a good book. But, I mean, Kirkman's doing some good stuff. It'll just be curious to see, again, now that he's with Image, are we going to see a faster output of stuff? Because, I mean, 10 weeks late for Walking Dead, again, based on when it was
originally solicited. He has a lot of issues of Invincible and Walking Dead solicited that have not shipped, a lot more so than a lot of other titles.
Oh, yeah, totally. Invincible itself is 22 weeks late from when it should have originally shipped. Now, granted, in both cases, we're only talking about 6 or 7 weeks since the previous issue. I mean, there's a chronic lateness to be had here. And what's interesting is some of the more schedulely challenged titles, we shall say, tend to be over at, and I don't want to pick on Image, but a lot of them at Image. Walking Dead, Spawn, Invincible, Savage Dragon, Brit, Elephant Men, Youngblood. All of these are, you know, at that, you know, 10-week or more late point. And, you know, as much as Kirkman was saying on his recent video about how, you know, go creator-owned. And I think that's great for any creator that wants to do it, and maybe not all do, and I certainly see no problem with that. If you're going to go creator-owned, you got to realize it's a bit higher risk, and that's where we're seeing a lot of the lateness happening. Now, it's certainly not limited to creator-owned. You look at titles like All-Star Batman and Robin and a few others at Marvel and DC, and you see some pretty egregious lateness there, too. But it seems like the work-for-hire stuff tends to come out on a better, more frequent basis, more reliable basis. And that's good for the creators. I mean, they have a more stable income. And I can certainly see where some creators would be very much in favor of a stable paycheck or predictable one. Going to another creator-owned book down at rank 235, we've got the second issue of Glamour Puss. And that was one I think we pretty much agreed was going to go down a little bit with that second issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. It dropped to well below half what it sold from the first issue, which did 16,514 units, to the second issue, which only did 7,088 units. And I say only, because, I mean, that's again, less than half what that first issue did. That having been said, it's still outselling some stuff from DC, a few things. Actually, most of what I'm seeing below it from Marvel is reorder stuff. It's still outselling a number of items, so it's not doing that bad. It's just a question of, you know, how much is it going to lose going forward? And a little bit above that, at rank 225, we've got the final issue of Omega the Unknown. And let's see, that one started at 19,303 units with its first issue and ended up at 7,589 units on that 10th issue. So I only lost about half the initial sales, a little over half, I guess. That actually, I think, did better than I would have expected. We're both kind of easy marks for a Marvel title, and both of us skipped it, so.
Yeah, but, you know, I think it just depends, you know, because I remember when I interviewed Mark Waid, he mentioned that Omega the Unknown was one of his favorite books that was coming out for Marvel. You know, Tim Rackrich, he loved that book.
Yeah.
I would, you know, just the art. I mean, it could be the best written book in the world, but aesthetically, the art in it I totally didn't appeal to me, and it just kept me away from the book.
The problem I see with this is kind of the same problem I see with something like Simon Dark. This has nothing to do with the quality and stuff. These books are neither fish nor fowl. They are for a specific audience, yet the way they're being published almost makes it hard for that audience to go find them. Omega the Unknown, in many respects, was kind of an indie-style book in terms of art style. I don't know about the story. But it was in, you know, the Marvel lineup of regular superhero stuff. So a lot of people who might have tried this and loved it, had it been an actual indie book in the back half of previews, probably never ventured into the Marvel catalog to go find it.
But, you know, knowing how the indie books in the back half of previews sell...
Fair enough. It probably
even though
better.
It was selling bad as a Marvel book, it sold a hell of a lot better than it would have if it had been an indie book.
If it had been indie book, I agree it would have sold less, but I think it would have lost less of a percentage of its initial sales.
True. And, you know, as far as the creators go, I mean, if you believe Kirkman, you know, they probably could have made a decent living. I don't know.
Well, they wouldn't have had the Marvel infrastructure to pay any percentage of, you know, so they could have survived at a lower sales level. You know, and, you know, Kirkman made a very good point of if you're at Marvel or DC or even some of these other bigger publishers, you know, Dark Horse or what have you, part of the sales for your book is expected to help cover the costs of the editorial department, the production department, the marketing department, you know, the rest of the corporate infrastructure. Whereas if you're a solo creator doing your own thing, you don't have that level of overhead, so you're able to go make more money on fewer sales.
Right.
It's just a question of, you know, how much is enough for you. What else do we have here that looks interesting? We finally got the second issue of Stephen Colbert's Tech Jansen at rank 219. And that did 7,950 units. That's down... 37.87% from that first issue, and that first issue came out a year ago.
Now, that one is one that I just don't understand. It's not like – I mean, who was writing that? Was it someone who had like a whole hell of a lot of better stuff to do or something? Or
I think it's some of the writers for his show, but I don't know.
How do you not
– part of the delay was the writer's strike. I just
don't understand it.
You know, this is one that I think there may have been legal issues that when the writers struck, they couldn't release, you know, promotional stuff or what have you, which this might have fallen under. So I think that was some of the delay. Now, that having been said, the writer's strike started, what, October, November? By which point, this series should have been in the can and out the door. So I don't totally buy that the writer's strike was all of the delay here. But given this drop between the first and second issue, I'm uncertain how the other ones are going to do, if they've even come out.
The other thing, I mean, I watch Colbert Report all the time. I mean, this guy has got a psychotically fanatical fan base. You see even all over Marvel Comics. I think it's Marvel Comics. Yeah. You know, it's like Colbert 08 posters, you know, in storefront windows and stuff. Artists just drawing that stuff in and, you know, he – like getting people to name bridges in Croatia after him and stuff, you know, it's like, and while he has like a small audience as far as television goes on a major network, his audience is huge by comic book numbers.
Yes.
And if he went on his show and said, "You're not a real Stephen Colbert fan unless you find a comic book shop in your community and buy a copy of Tech Jansen," there's no reason this would not be the number one book, you know. Well, other than the fact that they physically wouldn't have that many copies of it in the comic shops, and you'd have a lot of pissed off people.
Yeah, but I mean,
go to the comic shops and it wouldn't be there.
That would be funny if we see, you know, this under 8,000, you know, units for initial orders, but you know, a month or two from now we see, you know, 80,000 in reorder.
Yeah,
that would be hilarious.
But I don't know that he's done that kind of promotion for the book.
I would say clearly he hasn't. Yeah. And he should. I mean, he's got that platform. He's doing the comic in his name or whatever. Take advantage of it. Milk it for all you can.
Yeah.
There's no shame in that whatsoever. Now, one thing that's kind of an interesting clustering of titles, with the top one being at rank 197 and the bottom one being at rank 211, is the Star Trek titles from IDW. We've got the top-selling one of Star Trek Assignment Earth. We've got issue 3 there at, again, rank 197 that did 9,121 units. Then down at rank 201, we've got Star Trek Year 4 Enterprise Experiment number 3 at 8,971 units. And then all clustered together, we've got Star Trek Mirror Images number 2, rank 205, at 8,761 units. Right below that, Star Trek Year 4 Enterprise Experiment Number 4 at 8,740 units, followed immediately by Star Trek New Frontier Number 4 at an even 8,700 units. And then finally down at rank 211, Star Trek New Frontier Number 5 at 8,270 units. So really, you know, within about 1,000 units of each other from top to bottom are all the Star Trek titles, at least all the ones I'm seeing. I don't think there are any that fell out of the... No, I take it back. Star Trek Mirror Images is up at rank 183 with 10,322 units, and I believe that's all of the Star Trek titles. So pretty tight grouping of all of those, and I'm a little surprised, again, IDW doesn't have the biggest market penetration and stuff, that, you know, I concede Star Trek isn't where it used to be in terms of awareness and stuff, but there is a movie coming out, there are some people talking about that movie coming out, and, you know, 10,322 is the most Star Trek title is doing these days, you know. Flip side, 8,270 is the worst Star Trek is doing, you know, title is doing these days. And, of course, that one, The New Frontier, that's by Peter David. I mean, while this is... Star Trek New Frontier. This, to me, is, I don't say the best counterpoint to Kirkman's Stand, but that creator-owned might do better than non-creator-owned. This is essentially as creator-owned as Peter David could get while still having the power of the Star Trek brand behind him, and it's selling at this level. Now, I don't know how the New Frontier novels did, but this seems to be kind of the best of both worlds. You know, brand awareness as creator-owned as you can get while still having that for a corporate-owned brand.
Well, I mean, again, though, you know, the Star Trek, we talked about this before when we did the Star Trek books, but I mean, the Star Trek franchise has cooled significantly, you know, over the years. I think a lot of these things, when they're not actively on TV and in hardcore reruns, they just aren't, you know, capturing the audience. And again, who is pushing it? You know, do the people who are, you know, there's a lot of Star Trek fans out there. I can't imagine even the Star Trek fans are all buying. I mean, there's got to be more than that number of Star Trek fans. So,
I mean,
how are they even addressing this? I mean, is there like somebody at IDW should be hitting up every Star Trek message group and bulletin board on the web and website and peppering it with info about these Star Trek comics? And I don't know. I'm imagining that that's not happening based on these sales. I'm not on any of those Star Trek boards. But
I mean, you don't even necessarily have to go out to the non-comic book Star Trek fan to beat these numbers. I think there are more Star Trek fans in the comic book buying community, but that this is flying under the radar of. But it seems to be that there's a very core set of readers, because I would imagine the crossover, particularly between those titles that are all ranked, you know, concurrently, that, you know, it's more or less that same, you know, 8,700 people by and large getting those titles. I mean, maybe it doesn't have that much crossover between titles, but I'd be surprised if that was the case. But yeah, they need to push this a bit more and get the word out. That's one that just seems to me has definite possibility of selling better. And that there being a bigger audience for that material. So you see anything else that looks particularly interesting?
I'm continually astonished at something like slot 221.
Let's see, 221. Hulk Red must have. Yeah. They like doing those must-haves over at Marvel, don't they?
Well, I mean, $5 and they sold 7,800 of them. Why not do them? I mean, people are just like, stores are buying them. I assume that stores wouldn't keep buying them if people weren't buying them.
True. I'm just thinking, does the Hulk have enough issues out to be doing a must-have for it? But apparently they do.
You know, it's just, it's weird that many of those sell. It eludes me as to why that sells so much, but it's selling, you know, more power to them.
How is the Hulk title itself doing? Do we even have an issue this month? I don't think we do.
I think the Wolfskin annual did surprisingly well at 258. I mean, it sold 58.57. It was a $5 book from Avatar. You know, that's a decent amount of sales for a $5 book. And
Well, if you look at rank 256, Nocturnal's Carnival of Beasts one-shot at $7 did nearly 6,000 units. So
yep.
I think that while price can scare people off, there are people who are going to buy it if they're fans enough of the material.
Well, yeah, again, and you look at the Dan Dare, the last issue of Dan Dare that came out, that was a $6 price at $248,
yeah.
$6,227, you know, so there's some decent amount of money being made there.
I'll be curious to see how Dan Dare doesn't trade, because I thought that was a really, really good book.
Yeah.
That was one they should have come out with earlier, because I think that would have set the stage better for Virgin in terms of what their sales are capable of.
And I'm looking at the Marvel Adventures books that are all kind of usually bunched up down here at the bottom. Some of them have not even made the list this month.
So we've got Spider-Man, Marvel Adventures Spider-Man at rank 259 with 5,857 units. We've got Marvel Adventures Avengers at rank 269. Issue 26 of that did 5,416 units. And let's see, Marvel Adventures Hulk at 283. Issue 13 of that did 5,036 units. And
I don't know if an issue of FF came out this month or if that Marvel Superheroes one came out. But
I don't know.
I'm thinking back to Kirkman's. And I don't – this wasn't in his –
It was in his video that he was saying Marvel and DC should aim towards this younger audience.
Well, I'm talking about specifically in Suntress's Word Balloon interview where he pointed out that, like, you look at Marvel Adventures and kids are not stupid. They know that's not Spider-Man. And I know none of them are Spider-Man, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a fictional character. But, like, if I was a kid, I read Spider-Man. I would have no interest in reading Marvel Adventure Spider-Man if I was a kid.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to be reading. And some of lately, they've been slipping on the – I'm stopping getting the – personally, as of this list, I'm not buying the Marvel Adventures books anymore because they talk down to the kids now. That wasn't initially the case, but they've dumbed them down to the point where – I'm almost offended to read the things. And, you know, I don't think that's the way to capture a kid audience. You know, tell a good story like the old Marvel comics from the 60s and 70s that just wasn't full of adult themes and over-the-top violence and profanity and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, agree with that entirely.
You a kid's going to read that, and it's perfectly appropriate to them. And, you know, look at any of those first 150 issues of Spider-Man. You know, there was nothing objectionable about those, and they were all, for most part, and some of them were goofy, but I mean, most of those were really good comics. Why can't they do something like that? That's Kirkman's point.
Well, I think
this Marvel Adventures line's missing the boat.
Well, I think the other thing between that and some of the Johnny DC stuff based on the cartoons with, like, Justice League Unlimited and what have you is, not only are they talking down a bit in some of these titles to the kids, they're doing it as single-issue, standalone stories with nothing to draw you from issue to issue. And it's one of those where even if you like the story, it's over, it's done, and again, there's no incentive to go to the next issue. Whereas when I was getting into comics, not only was I reading the mainstream because it was appropriate for my age at that time, and I don't think it is now, but while you got enough story every issue and you got a sense of I don't say conclusion, but closure, there was enough subplots and stuff like that pulling you to the next issue. It's not the here's a single standalone, boom, it's done, next issue we start from scratch and kind of reset the clock. That's where I think a lot of these things like the Marvel Adventures are missing the boat. They need to make it a more habitual read and essentially a more addictive read than I think they're doing.
Yeah, and I think another point Kirkman made that, you know, he's a little younger than us, but, you know, he's like, hey, I'm loving Marvel and DC comics because they're being written for me. And he's like 30, right? Or something
yeah.
like that, or he's in his 30s. And he's like, hey, they're being written for me. And that's why I love them. But, you know, he's right. They're not writing these books for the kids. And while they're not writing them for the kids, kids are not stupid, so the solution is not writing. I mean, that's the difference. I mean, like, and that's why I think Marvel took off in the 60s, because you read, and they're goofy fun and everything. And I love DC, not as much as you do lately, because I'm kind of like going through one of my cycles, and DC's kind of getting on my nerves a little bit. But, you know, you look back at the 60s stuff, and there was some goofy shit coming out of DC. You know, some of those stories were just, you know, old white guys from New York, you know, telling stories that they thought were hip.
Yeah,
you know,
that definite out of touch.
If I was a real kid, I would be offended by a lot of those books, you know, and I just can't. And that's why when Marvel came along and, you know, Stan, you know, and after him, you know, Roy Thomas and a lot of these Jerry Conway, a lot of these other guys, they wrote books that appealed to a kid. They appealed to someone college age equally, but didn't talk down to them.
Well,
like
to me,
some of those, you know, hip, you know, kind of goofy things, which was sort of talking down, in my opinion.
That's the difference between an all-ages book and a book for kids. And some of this was the words Kirkman used versus what he may have meant. He kept talking about how Marvel and DC should aim towards the kids and the image should be the more mature type stuff, which is fine and good. But the one comment he made on the word balloon episode that John Suntress did, and anyone who's remotely interested in this whole discussion about Kirkman's video and stuff should go check out both the Kirkman episode that Suntress released recently of Word Balloon and the Bendis one that he did a few days later. But the statement Kirkman made that really just, I don't want to say set me on edge, but I just was perplexed by, was Suntress mentioned how when Image first came out, Kirkman was at about that 14-year-old age, and how, you know, Image was what drew him in. And how come Image can't be that now? And Kirkman kept saying, Image doesn't have the resources. Image doesn't have the resources. Image doesn't have the resources.
They didn't have the resources back then either.
What resources do you need? You tell a book that's appropriate for kids, you publish it. Image has the resources to do that. I would say Dynamo 5 fits this qualification.
Well, what Image does have the resources for? If you look back then, what did Image do to be where they were? They did, if you think of it, exactly what Kirkman is saying. You took a bunch of creators at the pinnacle of their popularity, Jim Lee, Rob Liefeld coming off of X-Force and coming off of X-Men, and McFarlane coming off of Spider-Man. And people were eating these guys up. They could not get enough of them.
But
right?
The funny thing is, it was as
and
much.
They came and they did creator-owned books, and people followed them and bought that stuff.
But it was as much the kids that followed them as the older.
Agreed. And it was, but my point is that you don't need the resources. So I disagree with Kirkman on that. But I do agree with him that if you actually take those creators at that point in their career where people are just loving them and will buy almost anything that they do, and you go over, so the only way you're going to get your Todd McFarlane fix is by buying Spawn. He's not doing Spider-Man anymore.
Do we have that level of rock star creator these days?
Not necessarily. Well, you know, you got to look at it and say, who are those kind of creators? You know, Bendis isn't going anywhere. I don't, for the most part, I think artists have that cachet, and I don't think as much that you have that ability with a writer.
I would agree with
it's
that.
It's much lesser extent with a writer. And who are those people today? I couldn't name them off the top of my head, so maybe there's not a crop right now of artists that are like that, that people are just so enamored of them. You have some of the old timers.
Hey,
but
got,
you know, when someone comes along, if some artist is out there and they're in that position that, you know, people are buying stuff just because they're drawing it, and just them coming on a book, you know, jacks its numbers up through the roof, they should do what Kirkman said. That would be a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, certainly he had a lot of valid points, and I think it was good for the discussion of comics, you know, for him to put that stuff out there. I think he probably could have done so in a more effective manner than he did, but I don't know that we have that rock star level creators, you know, artists and writers these days, by and large. I am not as convinced that if they were to go to Image or other creator-owned stuff, that as many people would follow these days as they did back in the 90s. I just don't know that the market is in the same place and the same level of trying out new material than back in the boom in the early 90s when Image started. But, you know, I'd love to be proved wrong. I would love for any creator that wants to go out, do creator-owned material, and be, you know, huge success at it. I think that would challenge Marvel and DC, make them step up their game both creatively and on a business level to make it, you know, more worth a creator's while to stay with them. I mean, really, that decision should be as hard as possible for a creator. Should I stay with a DC or Marvel? Should I go do my own stuff? And it should be hard both in terms of both being equally financially viable for them. But we're not at that point. But, you know, I'd like to see us get there. So anyone who has any questions or comments on anything we've discussed, please head to our forum and let us know. We're trying to beef up the level of discussion there. Certainly, I think these days, between Kirkman's video, how a lot of these books are selling, there's a lot of discussion to be had. So we'll see you on the forum. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themayoreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If you differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there is at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50.5 or excuse N items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside of Diamond Comics distribution channels is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.